Hi, I'm Kathy Graham, and I'm the moderator for today's session, which is basically focused on successful financial digital transformation through digital culture growth. And we're using a roundtable cross-functional group discussion process. To discuss this topic, we want you to be actively involved, so feel free to step on up and take a seat back there. Because this is a little different, we chose a different venue, a different process for this, and there's a reason behind it. I'm a digital culture expert, and my expertise is a combination of my education. I have an MBA in analytic finance, econometrics, and statistics from the University of Chicago, with an undergrad in marketing and business administration. And that's combined with my recruiting experience. I started off as a retained recruiter. And what I was known for was finding people who would fit the culture so well that they would stay on average 10 plus years and keep getting promoted. And that culture fit is something that I've always been known for and have grown on it to coaching. I now coach senior professionals all the way through the C-suite about where do they fit best in what organizations, where their choices are. And then I come over on the other side and I work with corporations that are facing a change, whatever the change is. And for the change to be successful, it's helpful that that they understand who the individuals are in their groups that are impacted and what can they do best and help them through the change. So that's how I became a digital culture expert. And I'm a subject, all of you use the word subject matter expert, SMEs? So we're four SMEs at this table. We're a cross-functional group. And my focus area is understanding of finance department organizational structures and responsibilities with the emphasis on the human capital, what people fit well in what areas to reach the next goals. And the other thing is communications and marketing of intangibles. So with that, I'd like to introduce, please introduce yourself.
Hello, hi everyone. I am Rakesh Amirneni. I'm the Director of Finance Transformation at LinkedIn, leading a team which defines the finance transformation strategy, architecture, innovation, adopting emerging technologies, and delivery of the capabilities for our stakeholders to empower them to be a better business partners to our business stakeholders.
Hi, my name is Anaïs Lampre. I'm the VP of Finance for Sweetgreen in Los Angeles. For those of you who don't know Sweetgreen, we are a fast casual restaurant group, really focused on the technology side as well as really the sourcing of the product towards the consumers. I currently lead the finance organization, meaning accounting, financial planning and analysis, payroll, all the good stuff. And I've come up the financial planning analysis track, mostly in high tech and high growth.
Hi, I'm Matilda Bay. I currently head up strategy and innovation for Budget Truck Rental. You probably know us or have seen our trucks going up and down the road and probably know it to be an industry that really hasn't changed. The model hasn't changed in 50 years. I'm currently tasked with reinventing the truck rental model, really driving what that will look like in the future. Which is an exciting space to be in right now. Mobility is very exciting. I tend to specialize in general transformation, not just digital, innovation, and strategy execution.
Great. And by the way, whenever you have a question, because we're doing this more casual and formal one-on-one conversation, a group conversation, though, anytime you have a question, just raise your hand, and we'll pass the mic to you. And also to Oliver, as you get online questions, just raise your hand and we'll pass the mic to you and then we'll go that way. How's that sound? So I think it's best always to start off with defining terms, especially terms like digital transformation. What does that mean? One definition that I came across said that a digital transformation is a term that means creating a new business and or shareholder value by shifting a business to the most up-to-date technologies. And so I'll start off with you, Attila. What do you think? Was that your definition of digital transformation, or do you have nuances or something different?
I think it's close. One of the things that I like to think about, Kathy, is transformation. When we say digital transformation, I think we get caught up in this idea that it has to be, like high-tech computerized transformation. And when I think on the definition that we have here, which I really like, it talks about using technology, but not necessarily computers. So when I think back on what Henry Ford did with standardized processes in an assembly line processes in automobiles, I think it would very much fit this definition without having even the term digital really available to him.
Interesting. Now, so what's different between Henry Ford's digital transformation and our transformations today?
I think when we get down to the real base or real root cause of the issue, I don't think that there's a whole ton of difference. When I look at what Henry Ford did, I think what made him super successful was his concentration on what improved the life of the customer. And I think if we use that in our transformations today, if we really tie it back to what's making things better for the customer, then our transformations are more likely to be successful.
Very good. Yes, would you like to add some, Rakesh?
So, I think when people say or present something on digital transformation, the pictures we see is all about robots and then iPads and this hi-fi coming in. I mean, it looks as if like digital transformation is synonymous to use the high-tech technologies, which essentially is part of it, but not the complete portion of that particular transformation. It's the digital transformation. Keep a word aside what digital is. Let's talk about a transformation is like pretty much, again, looking back, like going back to the zoom out and see what is the vision as a company we have, what values are we driving, what is the stakeholder value we should be driving, and then challenge what we are doing right now. Is it the right way of doing things? Keep aside the technology for time being. I'm not even talking about technology. Let's talk about, is that what we are doing right now, or is it just we are practicing what is being done for years? Is there a better way for us to do in what we do on a daily basis? It doesn't need to come from the top-down management saying that this is a huge transformation project that comes in that they want to initiate, which will disrupt everything. It's pretty much what you do day-to-day task, right? See what else you can change to make your life better. Go back and challenge all the policies we have, because those were written a while before. Is that in the context of new changing business models and the ever-changing economy, does it make sense for us? The process what we have right now, go back and challenge those processes and see how we can make it efficient. People as well, from a mindset of the people, like, okay, what are the different core values we need to stick to, and are the people aligned to that? If not, then how can we make them align? And then comes, in order to improve that, to go to that next stage, and go to the future stage, technology is just one aid to get there. It's all about people, process, technology. Everything has to go at the same pace to make us a successful company as a whole, not just only a technology-driven. So that's the reason the mantra at LinkedIn, where I come from, we have is like, it's a transformation-driven technology adoption, not a technology-led transformation, because the technology which is useful for some company may not be applicable for you. It all depends on what business outcomes you are looking for. What you are looking for, that drives what technology we should use.
So if I had to sort of add something, and I definitely agree with the rest of the panelists on sort of the transformation is just the transformation, and digital technologies is just the part of it. I think one of the ways in which, for example, at Sweetgreen, we're using technology in a really, really smart way is that we understand the dynamics of our gross profit over time. This is basically a finance audience, so I think everybody over here can understand these things very well. So when we're looking at sort of what makes up our cost basis, right, we have a lot of pressure coming from wage rates. We want to pay everybody a living wage, and we want to continue to give sort of our employees the best that we can. And what that means is that if we had to sort of extrapolate out the cost structure of the company, we're going to get into a position where either you're going to see margins really getting compressed, which is basically a lot of the problems which you've been seeing in retail today, or we're going to have to see the price of the commodities of the or offerings continue to grow, which is something which is not going to allow us to retain our competitive edge. So when we're looking at sort of the digital transformation sort of in a restaurant space or in a retail space, what we're trying to do is we're trying to say, okay, how can we integrate existing technologies or what are the future technologies which need to be created in order for us to minimize the non-value add processes within our organization, right? So we definitely want to continue to have sort of the people aspects working with our customers, but are there value, sort of very low value tasks which could be removed from the expense structure as well as from basically the chain, which will still allow us to provide an excellent customer experience and product while also increasing retention within our employees because we're not making them do repetitive, mundane tasks. And so basically taking the task force and really activating their value and removing the sort of items within that chain, which can be done by either a process change, a piece of machinery, or something like that. So I think the digital transformation is a little bit broader in the sense that it's basically just one of the tools which we are using in order to remain competitive and to ensure our margins are growing and valid over time.
And I really like that type of definition. And I'm going to recommend that if you're in any companies where the word digital transformation is making your employees fearful or fearful of their jobs or fearful of whatever, perhaps explaining digital transformation in this way, that it literally, what I'm hearing just from the three of you, it enhances the customer's experience, i.e. you will have more customers, so that's job security. It enhances your paycheck because they'll be able to afford that because they're digitalizing to keep the cost down from another avenue. And it's very much focused on what's going to reach the goals of the company. It's not necessarily from the top up, top down, like you're going to do this. So I think that some of these fears can be taken away if digital transformation is started to be explained in that method. Let's go tackle the other term and then we'll get into some scenarios, etc. The other one. What, in your mind, is digital culture? I'm going to start with you, Rakesh.
So, the word digital culture, I was like, when I saw the agenda, I was a little bit laughing at it, because for me, culture is what you are doing, practicing in the past over a period of time, repeatedly the same thing. That's what a culture is, which is like a backward looking. Okay, digital culture, digitization started like 3 years, 4 years before at a full speed. Is it a culture for us as a digital culture to start with? Because what we practice for the last 3-4 years is that the culture everyone we want to follow, it's going beyond that culture. What it means is, as a person, what are your values are? How do you adapt to that particular scenario? I mean, for example, you might have to be changing in these traits what you have, like to be more curious. Type of a scenario where an analyst or a junior resource before is like used to have this order taking mindset where, okay, my manager told me to do this in this way, so I need to get it this way from day one to day 30 and then close the books on day 30, right? Okay, now this is kind of like a culture where you're having a mindset of challenging even your managers in a positive way, not like challenging is like, how can I make my life better, right? And then being curious about it was more of like, okay, I get my tasks done. It's more of a silo kind of mentality we used to have, like, okay, let me get, but kind of like stepping into the other side with your upstream processes, downstream process, and trying to understand what exactly they do so that you get a better understanding when they say, this is what I do, you feel like why they're doing it in that way. If you go and step into their shoes and understand, now you get a perspective of what why they're doing certain things in a certain way, right? So that's the mindset we really has to have, like challenging how to make ourselves better. That's the culture we need to inculcate within ourselves as a leaders as well as within our teams as well. The second aspect for me is like ever learning. You have to keep on learning. Don't, it's kind of like, it's no longer like it's because I learned my accounting before where I know I had to debit my asset, credit my cash in case of certain scenarios. With that learning, we were able to sustain to a certain period of time. But now it's beyond that. If you want to be really a good business partner, not a financial expert, finance expert, then you should keep on learning the things that is happening outside the macro industry as well as within your company, as well as with across your cross-functional teams as well. That's the mindset we're talking about when we talk about culture here. I mean, I can talk about at LinkedIn, like our culture is like transformation is the first word we use there. Transformation, integrity, collaboration, humor, and results. So transformation is always the first one. When we say transformation, again, it's not the digital transformation. Transformation of everything, transformation of people, what we do, how do we operate as a company? I mean, how do we serve our customers at optimal value for them to our stakeholders, everyone, at sense. That's what the core starts for us with transformation to start with. That's a culture embedded within, which comes from the top-notch values itself. That's a culture that is embedded into everyone who is coming into that company.
Yeah. I think that, so again, I think digital is more immediate than it is sort of an end state. It's just a way in which something is done. I think we sort of tack on digital with the word culture to try and sort of frame the growth mindset in some sort of way. And so for me, I think what's really interesting about digital culture, I would say, is a couple of things. So first of all, it's the true sort of integration of the way in which teams work with each other and companies can work with subsidiaries or parts of the companies which are overseas, which are in different time zones. I think I had sort of the opportunity to work for a truly global company before I joined Sweetgreen, where everybody was basically working in different offices around the globe, and you absolutely didn't feel that the physical presence was necessary in order to get your job done in the best way possible. But that only can come about by having a very strong culture of performance. You can only do something like that if the selection of the employees is a pretty rigorous one, and you're continuously bringing in people who have sort of the same culture and appetite to that culture, right? People who will continue to be productive in situations of sort of ambiguity and very low amount of sort of supervision, and that's not what necessarily would motivate them. I think one of the other things which is really interesting when we think about sort of the concept of the digital culture, it's about the way in which we communicate with each other and the way in which we communicate with our clients and with our customers, right? So I think there's a subset of the population who really loves the ability to continuously do everything without ever having to speak to somebody. Like, I think there are certain things which I personally really like one of an example is the Uber customer service. I've never actually had to interact with a human in order to get credit for a mistake that Uber did. But I do also believe that a lot of people might find that very impersonal, right? So I think that it's around basically trying to figure out the right balance and what works for your customers, and at what point we start to have to actually stay away from digital only channels in order to make sure that the experience remains human and it remains whole.
Thanks. So I tend to segment this up a little bit. When I look at the term digital culture, I like to first look at what culture really is, and I subscribe to the Christensen frame of thought on that. And the way that Christensen describes culture is he describes it, picture a startup company, and they have a problem. They try to solve that problem. They find a task to solve that problem that is successful. They then repeat that task. As that task gets repeated over time, it becomes a process. That process repeated over time becomes a company's culture. In very simple terms, culture to me from a business perspective is how we do things here. If we really boil it down, in business, that is what culture is. So when we layer on digital, what does that mean to me? That means to me that we're using some type of technological solution to possibly solve problems differently. But we always have to bring that digital piece back to the customer of the process. So if we layer those two together and we say we're always trying to improve, improve the experience of the customer of that process, then we get to what I think digital culture really is. If you can improve how a customer's experience is through technology, whether that customer is outside of your organization or is a customer of an internal process, if we can use technology to make their experience better, then we're actually driving a digital culture.
So I think, again, all three of you have done an excellent job of explaining it, and I hope it makes it clearer. Let's put it in a historical framework. I think that a majority, maybe it's not a majority, but at least half of companies in the U.S. are still working in a traditional work setting where everything is siloed, like you were talking about, and you did your task and you did it, especially in the accounting finance area. And now, because technology has changed, because there have been so many disruptors to industries, the traditional companies are now needing to look at how do I change so that I can stay in business. And Avis is a perfect example. We were talking about their model. LinkedIn is a new company that started with it and transformations right at the top. Their culture is probably always was digital culture, whereas Avis is changing and Sweetgreen is in between, right? So I think it's good. So you look first at your company and say, where am I on this spectrum and what's driving the need to change and how much of the digital culture and in what order do I need to do it? So I think that's what we wanted to bring out with the definition before going into something, because a lot of communication errors can occur if you don't start with defining what the terms mean. Does anyone have any questions on that? Then let's go ahead.
Sure.
Yes.
I mean, I guess to understand one thing, sometimes you want to understand the opposite. So what is an analog culture? How would you what are we coming out of in order to understand that this is, we're trying to say that this is different, separate, or so forth. So how do we describe an analog culture?
Go ahead, or yes.
I think that's a really good question. And I like to compare and contrast things. So, you know, to rephrase for the folks that are watching us online, you're asking us to define what an analog culture is so that we can compare and contrast with a digital culture.
Yeah.
And I think that is a really good question. The way that I would define like an analog culture is perhaps a more traditional definition of culture, like I was talking about before, where it's really about process, maybe no real concentration in how do we bring more modern technology into that culture. So I would, maybe you've all heard the analogy from the space race era, where the United States worked very actively on developing a ballpoint pen. So it was an instrument that could write in zero G, really neat technology. I mean, real breakthrough in writing. And the Russians used a pencil. So you know,
there you go.
You know, so I mean, in that example, I would say the ballpoint pen is probably digital in that comparison, and the pencil is very analog. Now, which one is better? I think that's really hard to define. I mean, the Russians probably spent less money on developing a writing technology, but they also probably got less benefit. I mean, how many of you, I'm looking around the room, and almost everybody has a ballpoint pen in their hand. So the ballpoint pen was a wild success from a national perspective. So I think, you know, it depends on how you define success in that factor.
Some of us are operating on a stylus.
Right. I didn't want to call you out. Yeah. See, you're very high tech.
And that's very interesting because this is accounting and finance. And accounting and finance people, we used to use pencils. Remember those high-grade pencils? I used them all the time. I don't even know where they are anymore. And now we're going to very digital. We're actually writing on a stylus. So a great example, great question. Now, let's look at digital culture issues. I want to be very clear, are not woo-woo topics. It's a key financial element and an advantage to a company to create a digital culture. Let me give you some facts to support that. Recent McKinsey research shows that culture, I'm quoting, cultural obstacles correlate clearly with negative economic performance. And what that means is that as finance leaders, who can motivate their groups to change to a digital culture, and the right and correct one for your corporation, can gain an economic advantage for their company. And there are a lot of definitions of what are the qualities of digital culture people. And I personally like the one that Capgemini has come up with. And they said there's seven dimensions of individuals who have changed from a traditional to a digital culture. And these seven are: they're customer-centric, they collaborate, they have an open culture, they display agility and flexibility, they think first of a digital solution, they utilize data-driven decision-making, and they are innovative. And I want to ask our panel here, at each of your very different industries, which of those qualities that are most prominent and resonate among your employees, and what did you do to grow that characteristic? So I haven't started with you. Go ahead.
Sure. So I think one of the things which really stands out is that probably four or five of these are on our culture board. And they're considered part of our leadership competencies at Sweetgreen, which is quite funny, mainly because we developed those leadership competencies through sort of a lot of group work with our leadership team. And I think one of the things which is really sort of the train of thought between all of this is that there's an element of being able to challenge the status quo in a safe environment. I think one of the things which we continue to strive, I think all of us individually and as groups, is that we want to be open to change. We want to be open to looking at things from different angles. That's why, you know, diversity has become so important in a lot of our organizations. Sort of that different perspectives that the diverse work culture will bring in is something which is very rich. Now, the thing is that a lot of us have quite a gap between trying to understand how that happens, right? How do we move from our current state to that end state? And one of the things which I really look for, and I think which is really important in my organization, is that we need to bring in people who are able to flex, right? Many times we want to do certain things, and, you know, priorities change, especially in the finance organization. Sometimes we are not at the top of the stack. Something else comes in. What happens? So I think one of the things which is really important around sort of the innovation, collaboration, having an open culture, being agile and flexible, is trying to be able to look at the tools which are at hand, and figure out how we can do better with what we have. Right? It's not always about changing. I think one of the problems with this sort of digital transformation, digital culture, digital everything, is that we think that the product is going to solve our issue. The product very rarely solves your issue. A lot of it has to do with sort of the processes and the people who are managing those processes. How many times have we spoken about, you know, bad data, or the data is dirty, or we can't use this data because it doesn't make any sense. If we had to spend more time sort of in trying to understand what's the end state, we'll realize that probably 75% of the transformation itself is more around processes than it is just around the system.
Can you give a good example of that? I'm going to have you talk just a little longer. I have a couple questions, so let me go back. Just so that we're all on the same, what is a culture board? You mentioned that.
Yeah, sure.
And how did you create it?
A lot of sort of organizations today have recognized that mission and purpose is one of the most important aspects of the culture within the organization, and being able to sort of associate the work that you're doing every single day with a greater purpose, with the mission of the company has become really important. So one of the things which a lot of companies are doing today is they are sort of trying to figure out what are the five or six sort of pieces of information which link everybody together. Are there sort of values that are shared within the organization, especially if you're looking at sort of a multicultural space, or you're looking at very different orgs. So, you know, many times the finance people think very differently than maybe you have your marketers. But what are the seven terms or five themes which we find throughout the organization? And many times those are iterated on, and we get to a point where everybody can agree upon a set of values. And then those values are usually either displayed physically within the organization or they're spoken about. I think one of the big differences between what I'm speaking about and sort of the mission statements that we are all very accustomed with in office lobbies is that the values are much more grassroots, right? It's something which really comes out of from the teams rather than being sort of a top-down mission statement that we probably got a very good consultancy firm to write for us. So that's what I was speaking about, our mission board, yeah.
And one last question. How do you want people that can flex? Are there some tests that you have discovered? How do you go and discover how someone can flex? Or is that just over time you discover it?
So,
and then if I'm putting you on your spot, you may take a pass.
No, I think it's a really interesting question. I think that one of the things which I personally have continued to use, especially in the recruiting process, is trying to look at how that person arrived in front of me. Right, so I just made a hire a couple of weeks ago. A girl who's going to be joining our finance team as our first really finance associate, who basically is going to be one of the strongest collaborators for myself and the CFO of my organization through sort of a rotational type of program. And what was really interesting is that she came towards me on LinkedIn, and get a lot of LinkedIn requests, but the way in which she came and the way in which she approached the subject was just so valid. She really, really, really realized like what she needed to say, and it was very thoughtful. And the grit is something which I really, really like in people. I like people who are go-getters, right? Who are actually going to go ahead and put themselves out there at risk of failing. And once I was able to meet her, it was pretty immediate, within sort of 30 seconds that, you know, you actually see the person physically, that you realize that there's a lot going on in the brain, right? The questions that people ask, the way in which they approach subjects, usually are very big tell signs. But I think one of the biggest things in understanding if people can flex is their curiosity, and that is most of the time very, very prevalent in a resume. Mm-hmm. It is. Like sports, for example, people who have played sports or have participated in team sports, people who have, you know, a lot of sort of cultural activities or just a lot of personal interests.
Go ahead.
Adding to what Anne is telling, I have an interesting hire 3 months before. So that was to lead our finance strategy and emerging technologies practice within our team. And the first thing where people were looking for was like, does the person has got a finance background or not? But what we looked for was like, let me put it this way, we had chosen a candidate who has never worked on finance, has a PhD in chemistry. She did her 4 years degree on Ayurvedic in Carolina, back in India. And she's a pro photographer, and she plays sports. Yeah. Okay, no relation to finance background at all. Then in the first round of interviews where we had put her in, the feedback was like, she doesn't have a finance background. The way we looked at it was like, I have a team of 14 people already there. Some of them are CPAs. Some of them are chartered accountants back in other countries. There is already enough knowledge of that finance in this space. We need someone to come out from look from a fresh perspective who doesn't know finance about it, because that person will challenge everything we are doing. Otherwise, if a person has got a finance background, there is always this notion or impression of how finance works, and we carry on with that notion and notion what we had, what we were taught in our experience in education, will continue with that particular aspect. Rather, someone coming and looking at it, right, within 2 months, we had seen enormous results out of it. I mean, if you go back and look her desk, you'll see questions, why here, why this, why not this, all the stuff on the whiteboard behind, and she asks everyone, regardless whether that person is an analyst all the way to VP, she just goes and asks everyone, why are we doing in this way? So that has helped us tremendously to change how we are looking at that particular one.
I love that example, and so I'm going to comment on that from there. If you're changing from a traditional culture to a digital culture, one of the first steps that I recommend is you look at how does the group work together currently, and to achieve whatever the goal is, and what are the qualities, the capabilities, soft and technical, already present in the current group members. And then two other things that people might not think about that are highly important is Professor Ron Burt from the University of Chicago utilized chaos theory to discover something called the social network of a group. So identify before you start changing, who is the person who's the social salve in that group? The one that if X isn't getting along with Y, somehow gets them to accept things. The person who has the whole memory of what's going on in that organization, including where things are two system changes ago. Who is the person who has the relationships with the outside vendors? Who's the best person in taking care of all the internal relationships? And who's taking care of the customers the best, or whatever business managers that you're working with? And identify that in addition to looking at what is the political structure, and what the current political structure is. Because sometimes leaders are not always necessarily aligned, nor are job functions aligned with who's doing what. It changes. And when you look and understand that, then you can say, I'm needing to change the culture to this to achieve this goal, this digital transformation goal. What are the missing qualities in this group? Or how am I going to have to transform this group to reach that goal? And those items that you just mentioned, these characteristics, are so excellent. And in the Capgemini list, have a lot of the different qualities that may or may not be there currently in the group. That tells you, can I train someone? Or do I need to outside hire? And what kind of combination? And yours, you didn't need more finance. You needed more team and more creativity and more challenge. So then he did an excellent hire, as you did, in bringing in people that had that. But to do it, you need to first look at your group.
If I may add,
sure,
the way when we interview people or when we try to bring new persons into our team, the way we used to do is like, okay, does he has this qualification? Does he have this X number of experience in this particular space? Or does he has worked in this industry, in our industry, relevant to us? But now, when at LinkedIn, what we do, we consider them a bit, but what we look for is how do they match to our core values? Our core values are like members first, relationship matters, be honest, open, be collaborative, take intelligent risks, and kind of like act as an owner as well. So those are the key core values, and that's what we try to measure them against. It's not about measuring only while taking in, but it's also about like how do we make sure we reinforce them or make sure they remind about them while they're at LinkedIn? I mean, the way we do it is all the promotions, if you're yearly appraisals, we actually rate against those values, not against the deliverables they did and what the feedback we got. And even if you have any appreciation like the awards we need to give, or we need to give kudos to everyone on the team, there's a categories that are aligned to these particular ones. So and if you go into LinkedIn offices, you would see display boards about all this, act like as a owner everywhere. So it's kind of visible physically. And while you do the work, while you're being recognized, while you're being hiring, everything is around these particular values. That's what we measure against at LinkedIn.
So. I'm going to task you, Attila, to start on the next question and come back to these, because it still involves it. We're finance and accounting, and there are technical skills people need, and yet, digital transformation in finance needs to occur. So I want to start off with you, Attila, and ask you, what has been your most memorable finance digital transformation success? And I know things involve that in what you've been doing. And what were the key elements that made it successful? And yes, you may add some of the digital culture elements in.
You're absolutely right that those are tied in together, Kathy. I appreciate that. The thing that we're working on right now at Budget Truck Rental, where we're redefining the model, the entire truck rental model that hasn't changed in well over 50 years, has required us to really look at our agility and our flexibility, and really look at how we interact with people. I think. To go back to what my fellow panelists were saying, I think Simon Sinek, for anybody who was here yesterday and caught Sinek speaking, one of the things that he talked about in there is that we overvalue skills and we undervalue humanity. And to me, that's a great summary of what I just heard on the panel, in that we can take somebody who doesn't have a finance background, and they can be an exceptional member of that team, because it helps us see from different points of view. It helps us be agile. It helps us be flexible. It helps us have the things that we need to have in order to, really get ahead, to drive a transformation forward. When I look back on, how did we drive that transformation in our company? I tend to look at, agility and flexibility are huge for me here. But I look back on really experiences, or drew upon experiences that I had from my years in the Marine Corps. One of those was what I call centralized command, decentralized control. What that means is that we set a vision for where we want to go, but if we don't tell people exactly how to do that every step of the way, they're more likely to have the agility and flexibility that they need to actually get it done. An example that I've heard before was, blindfold somebody and tell them to walk in a straight line to a point. That's fine. If there's nothing in their way, they can do it. If you tell them how to do it, they can generally do it. But if you put a chair in the way, some people are just going to stop when they hit the chair. Other people are going to go around the chair, which violates what you told them to do, which prevents them from being agile, prevents them from being flexible. An award that I like to give out is what I call a Semper Gumby figurine. If you're old like me and you remember what Gumby is, Semper Gumby comes from the Marine Corps' Semper Fi, which means always faithful. Semper Gumby, we say, means always flexible. I really like to drive agility and flexibility, because I think that's a skill that you just have to have.
And that's without losing controls. I mean, because finance and accounting is about controls, but transforming it so it's more working with the business partners and coming up with solutions rather than past data. And
yes.
And so that you become a business partner, or are a business partner to the C-suite, enabling them to have the financial and accounting data now so that they can take changes now in real time so they don't get disrupted. And it's there in finance and accounting. Would you like to comment on that? Or would you like to, Rakesh?
Sure. I think one of the things which is really important and something which probably many of us have actually encountered in our own careers is that it's really important to be very honest with candidates as to what they're actually going to find when they join. And then I think before that, we have to be very honest with ourselves as to who we're actually hiring for that job. Many times we try to fit the wrong profile, maybe because we don't have the budget, or maybe because we don't want to admit how entry level a task is. But I think that being very honest with sort of each role and responsibility within our organization actually allows us to hire better people. And one of the examples that I can give as it relates to this is, you know, in the finance world, I think finance has many different aspects to it, right? So if you're bringing in somebody who's going to be trading foreign exchange, their technical skills are very, very, very important. Now, if you're going to be bringing in an entry-level sort of staff accountant, their technical skills are probably not as important. And we can continue to say that they are, but they probably are not. The truth is that there's going to be a structure in place which will allow to build anybody who has sort of an analytical abilities or who is curious to become excellent in that role. And sometimes what happens is we try and bring people in who are too high of a level for certain positions, and then they end up getting really bored. They actually end up distracting a lot of the people around them, and everybody loses. Whereas on the other side, if we bring somebody in who doesn't have the technical skills which are necessary, we can make extremely costly mistakes for the organization. So I think one of the things which you really have to sort of think, and we need to spend a lot of time doing, is as leaders, have we actually understood what the right size for each role is? And when we hire, we shouldn't hire someone for the short term, we should hire someone for the medium to longer term. So if you think that your company is going to be different in 1 year, probably not a good idea to hire someone who was good for your company yesterday.
To add to that, I think the way we looked at it before was we tried to put a barrier between the skills and the soft skills. I mean, like technical skills and the soft skills. I'll give an interesting example. At LinkedIn, it is like 2-3 years before, where our team, which we were right now, is like 4-year-old. After 1.5-year-old, we came up with this one barrier. Like, traditionally, our team was focused on transforming using ERP products. With this digital technology coming in, okay, now we as a team has identified that we should be moving towards this direction. Okay, then the question came to us was like, okay, I have the 6 people there who is expert in that transformation using ERP products. Should I bring a new people who has this digital transformation experience? But we went against that particular model and said, okay, what about empowering our existing talent to expose them out? So we created a model, we call it as 30-40-20-10. What it means is 30% of a time of a particular resource has to be spent on the areas where we consider them as experts. So if in this functional area you are expert in credit and collections, or you're expert in revenue accounting, transforming that particular process. And then we have a 40 rule, which is the one where, okay, you need to expand, meaning you don't need to be expert in the other areas, but if you're a revenue accounting, you should know all the way from quote to order to bill to invoice to an extent you want to know so that you can get holistic perspective of it. And we're giving them opportunities to work in that spaces where they get the chance to expose to that areas. And the other 20% we called as emerge, which means you are free to go out into the market in the areas of where you're interested in, and then try to learn about those. It just needs to be a technology. It could be like any kind of stuff that is happening outside in the world that could be relevant for LinkedIn. Just bring it back in and incorporate it. 10% is for meetings and your personal development. So 3 years before, there is other functions within LinkedIn that are like kind of like little ahead in the journey by hiring an external people to support them in bringing the emerging technologies like RPA, AI, machine learning. But if I fast forward for 2 years after that, our our team, which focus more on customer to cash cycle in at LinkedIn, we are the first one to bring a chatbot into LinkedIn. We are the first one to bring in predictive analytics into LinkedIn. We are the first one to bring the cognitive bots into LinkedIn. So that has helped us in order to help scale ourselves immediately, because the talent know how LinkedIn operates. The talent know how relations between the within the departments. They know everybody who can collaborate across around. If a new person comes in, it takes like another 6 to 9 months to get into the stage where they are, and then start their journey from there would have slowed down as a bit, but expanding our people or itself has paid us a lot. So just look for the talent within your team, talk to the team, and figure out what they really want, are interested in, and send, give us exposure to that areas, chances to that areas to work on.
This is a great technique that you can use in many different ways when you're moving from one state to another. I was on a consulting engagement where a private family-held company wanted to go IPO. There was no heir apparent, and the person that was the owner wanted to reward the employees with having ownership in the company and getting a reward from going IPO public. And so we were on a very tight timeline to take a private company cash-based firm, never had been through an audit, had private systems, cash-based, all the way up to passing their first audit and becoming GAAP compliant. And others might have chosen to get rid of the entire private accounting team, but that wasn't the choice that this one made, and it was a good choice not to make, because those individuals, like you just mentioned, have all these other social network skills and knowledge that also leaves with them. And so what we did was something very similar. So start thinking about pairings. So instead of hiring a bunch of public accountants to come in and change everything, what we did is we paired every single person that was there with a public accountant who had the expertise in the new area. The private one didn't have that knowledge, but knew about the company, and they were forced to work together. No one forced them, but they, both of them, to have a win, needed to work with each other, because the private person needed to learn the public skill to keep their position going forward, and it would enhance their value tremendously. And the public company person, to get to IPO and put that notch on their belt, needed to learn what the company was doing currently. Everyone. So look for those win-wins. And we landed up hiring half the people we needed to do. And the old system kept working, while the new system went up much faster. Other areas that you can do outside of the accounting area or internally, we were talking yesterday about FP&A and accounting. Sometimes there's friction in those areas. Come up with win-wins that create the company getting to that digital goal, the transformation point, that they need to both work together, each providing their expertise. And by the time that process is finished, you will have two people that can work well together because they needed to. So that is a really good point. I'm glad you brought that out, and that's an excellent way. And those, you get successes from them, and big successes. So let's go to the obstacles, because digital transformation, there are many that are not success stories. And one of the big major reasons comes down to this human capital, the digital culture. It's different. It needs to change to support it. So let's talk in the group, and I'm going to start with you, Rakesh. You, each one of them came up with a different noteworthy obstacle that they've encountered when working on finance digital transformation.
Yep. So
how did you go over it? Get past it.
There is this people aspect, and there is this generic aspect of it. What people look at finance is like, they are risk averse, and digital transformation would increase the risk, and people or kind of puts a barriers in between just not to go there, right? Is it really true that the finance is a kind of like a risk-averse company or risk-averse personalities there? But I think it's the way we actually go them and approach them and tell to them. If you show an analyst who is there in FP&A or accounting who is doing their day-to-day job, you bring them onto a meeting and say, show the picture of like digital transformation. There is human beings just replaced with robots. And you say, this is, goes back to like, is that what we are really saying to them, that we are getting replacing people, humans, with bots and machines? That's not really true. That's a sales pitch for the vendors who are who are making that products. That makes sense because that's their living. I get that piece. But when we go and talk to them, to our employees, let's not show that to them and then scare them out of it. It's the augmenting you. It's the story for them is like it's augmenting you to be a better person and to succeed, rather than always running a macro, always doing a repeated job every day. I am giving you an opportunity for you to leave or kind of optimize your day-to-day work, and in the spare time, look at how you can be a better valued partner to your business. I mean, rather than heads down working for 16 hours on the stuff, okay, let's use this as an opportunity for improve yourself, transform yourself, and have more better success growth factors to you. I mean, we can talk about it, many examples at LinkedIn. One classical example was like we had reduced our revenue close cycle from 13 days to 3 days. And with that, the revenue analysts are given an opportunity to work with their sales partners, and they're part of the deal structuring process to tell them if they get discounts by X percentage, this is how the impact is going to be on revenue. This is how your gross margin is going to change for you. So they become a good business partners. The second classical example was like we did transform our credit and collections process where we automated that process, and now we are also giving visibility to our sales leaders or sales people how the customers are performing from a payment processing standpoint, so that they can make intelligent risk of should I give more discount because I'm getting payments on time, or should I be not giving, flexing them on the payment terms because it's a bad customer as well. So that people work with the collections to get it. So it's kind of like the other one was like we expose our financial data to our business partners, which is traditionally not the case where everyone thinks that finance data is to be should be secured. I get that piece of certain things which we cannot expose, but wherever we can expose it, let's not keep it as a magic ball inside finance. Let's expose to the extent what we can have, so that we build trust with them and then we gain respect from them as well.
And a question, Rakesh, that comes out to me is some people will not have those natural talents to learn to communicate with sales, etc. Does LinkedIn's HR department have that? Do you use outsourced coaches? How do you help grow? And when is there a point that just say, this is not the area?
Got it. So, again, we don't want to keep people in an uncomfortable zone if they are not comfortable with it. I mean, it's always a discussion between a manager and a resource to talk about what they're interested in and what they're comfortable with. And then some people, as Anas was telling, they want to be like collaborate, go back and talk to the people. Some people want to be siloed and doing certain things on their own in an isolated way. We all respect all kinds of mentalities, all kinds of aspects. We are highly diversified company as well, right? So it all depends on what the person wants. And there are many other avenues where we can use them. If they really don't want to be exposed to the sales and talking to them, they're not comfortable in that space. We always use them in other areas based on their skills and their merits, and keep it as a win-win for everybody.
See, and I'd like to point that out. That's a big difference from a traditional model where you were saying to the person, hi, you need to do X to get promoted, and you need to go here and do this. That's a top-down. Now it's more of a communication, you know, and an assessment of what would you like to do? What are your skills? These are our opportunities, and doing more of that communication. And HR is excellent in many companies. There are actual HR specialists now in these areas of having conversations in large organizations and smaller ones. We were talking yesterday, I think, about how your firm outsources those coaching and consulting. So there's many, many different choices, but it's a conversation to carry it over, and it takes the fear away in an employee thinking, oh my goodness, a robot's coming and I have to do something or I have no job.
You just took my...
Oh, I'm so sorry.
You just stole my thing, Kathy. I was also going to address the fear. I think that's really important. But I think the flip side of the fear, and this is one of the things which I don't think we necessarily think about or really are very honest about, really, when we think about the barriers to transformation or why sometimes transformations fail, is that I actually think that we don't project the savings coming out of transformations in a correct way. And many times we look at sort of a charge or we put together an Excel sheet. I have, you know, put together many, which say, oh, once we get this system in place, once we add this new tool, all of a sudden all this headcount is going to disappear. All this expense is going to go out the door because we have this new system. And we're going to substitute this expense with, you know, either increased distribution expense or whatever type of system software expense we have on the books. The truth is that I have very rarely, in my experience, and having seen many different systems be put in place into many different companies, seen any headcount or true meaningful headcount reductions coming out of the addition of a system. Most of the time, what we see is a change in roles. So maybe before we had more processors, now we have more reviewers, right? Maybe before we had more errors, now we have basically better quality. But the truth is that I think we tend to overestimate many times the true financial impact of a digital addition or digital transformation. And what happens is that we set expectations with the business incorrectly. So on one side, we now get into a situation where we have to make savings somewhere, and sometimes we have to make hasty decisions as to basically backtrack or back into the numbers which we had originally put. And the second piece is that sometimes we don't really realize that we can have sort of like a blip or a reduction in headcount, and then all of a sudden we're going to start seeing sales decline, right? Or we're going to start seeing customer complaints increase. All of a sudden, other expenses are starting to increase. So I think, like, as finance professionals, as FP&A professionals, as finance leaders, we have to be very cognizant of the realistic aspects of the finance transformation and not try and bank a lot of the savings until they happen. And one of those things is going to what you were saying, Rakesh, is that we have to take what our vendors are saying with a grain of salt, right? And even though I think it's important that we take into account sort of some of the aspects which they're bringing into the sales pitch, we have to be able to localize and to really correct for what they're saying. And that's why we need experts in the room to help us do those things. And many times the experts have to be independent from those vendors. So the vendor selection of the implementation, making sure that you're working with partners who you can actually trust and who have no vested interest in the product being installed is very, very important, I personally think, for the success.
And I think we're talking about noteworthy obstacles that you've encountered.
Yeah, yeah. So to bring it back around to that, I would like to talk to noteworthy digital transformation obstacles that I've experienced specifically in the innovation space, and I see this a lot, I think, especially with publicly traded incumbent businesses, like the one I work at. The biggest obstacle that I see is what I call the good money, bad money cycle, and what I mean by that is when a business matures, it generally gets to a point where growth becomes difficult, especially when that industry becomes oligopolical. We have very few competitors, and if you look at the car and truck rental space on either side of it, we're very much there. There's a handful of players that control the vast majority of the market, and that's where there is. So there's not a lot of M&A growth opportunities, but you still experience that growth pressure. Shareholders are still looking for you to grow that business. So, you know, how do you go about growing a business where the majority of the M&A that the SEC is going to allow has already occurred? And we're definitely in that area. So you get a lot of pressure to grow. And the way to grow, if you don't have M&A, is through innovation. Those are basically your two opportunities. So when you start to innovate, a lot of publicly traded companies have a lot of pressure for immediate, you know, next quarter returns. And unfortunately, with innovation, if you're really innovating, you're doing something that nobody's ever done before. You don't really know, you know, to your point, you don't really know when those savings, when that growth is going to come through. Unfortunately, if it doesn't come fast, the pressure from the shareholders can shift from "we want you to grow" to, you know, why are your margins decreasing? Why are you returning less to shareholders? And usually, what's happening is, the company is investing in a future. They're investing in R&D, and you see those margins decrease because of that, because there's a lag to getting the return out of innovation. But unfortunately, you can't tell the shareholders we're going to see that return in a year. We're going to see it in 6 months, because frankly, you don't know if you're doing real innovation. So the shareholders start to put the pressure on you to stop that, to cut the cost, which unfortunately leads to killing the innovation opportunities. And, you know, the example I like to use here is Blockbuster. If any of us think that the Blockbuster executives didn't see, digital movies being the future, they saw it. They absolutely saw it. They started shifting their business into that. They had the support of the shareholders. This exact cycle happened. The shareholders then started pushing back, saying, "Why are you cutting late fees? That's where we make, I forget what percentage of the business, but that's where we make so much of our money, is off of late fees." So the shareholders push them to put the late fees back in. Customers start leaving for Netflix, and now there's, one Blockbuster left? Is that what I heard?
Really?
Up in northern Canada? I think there might be one. That's what Cinex said yesterday, anyhow. So, how do I overcome that? For me, overcoming it is a matter of talking to, especially finance and accounting folks, about setting realistic expectations for when we're going to see this improvement actually come through. Help me bake in enough of a loss into a P&L so that we can actually absorb the reality of what's going to happen. So they can either be my best friend or my hardest obstacle, depending on their viewpoint. But it's imperative that we bake this in and that we understand it. Because if we don't, then we'll likely end up Blockbuster.
And I love your analogy there. And Anna East had a session yesterday that I attended where you brought out some more ways to get past obstacles like that. If you have built bridges in the business partners, you were talking about turning finance into a co-pilot and working with the C-suite and providing value added in real terms of financial information that'll help pivot. When you're in one of these situations where an innovation is going to take more time, and I'll let you gladly tell about it a little more, but you were talking about having that real-time data enables you to see, well, you know that this is going to take this more. Where are the other places that we can cut short-term costs? And I have relationships with those areas to talk about it. Did you want to talk a little more about it, or that pretty much summarizes it?
No, I really think it does. But basically, what I was trying to say is that, and what you were pointing out, is that thinking about the company as a system, as one system, and not a bunch of individual departments who don't really work together. And so if there is one area, as you were saying very eloquently, where we are not seeing sort of the savings which we expected, or we're going to have a pretty bad story to tell, let's see which other areas can contribute. And most of the time, we realize that executives really do understand that it's not it's the sum of the parts that matters, right? Not just the individual areas. And so many times there are decisions or triggers which could be pulled in order for us to sort of save the bottom line, even from just like a quarter over quarter perspective. So, yeah.
That's great. And the other thought that we were coming across is, and this is a barrier, is many companies still have functional silos. And one of the areas that finance and accounting can be very instrumental and really gets a seat at the table, Nicole from had a whole session on that. She was with Coca-Cola, and her session was about how to create successful cross-functional partnerships. So if you get an opportunity to look at her tape, she had some very interesting ones, and I'm going to give credit to her for having said that, and then we're going to go into questions. Where are we at in time-wise?
We've got 5 minutes left.
Oh, my goodness. Well, then, watch Nicole's. Let's take the questions, and we can send that to you later. So, what questions do individuals have related to anything that you wanted to know? Yes.
In any of your experience, have you ever had instances where it's been kind of a bottom-up inspiration for making change, or has it always been like a top-down, let's drive this new culture?
So for us, it's a mix of both, meaning...
Yes.
Okay. So the question was, like, do you have ever encountered a bottoms-up approach of transformation versus a tops-down approach of transformation? So we do have a mix of both, meaning the core values that has been set up are at the transformation at highest level, but no one tells us in terms of defining the strategy and how to achieve that particular transformation. It's all about the individuals who comes out and then identify what they want to be, and then how do they want to excel themselves, how do they want to be better, and talk to the managers and make sure that everyone is aligned to that one. So on our side, we do have a quarterly OKRs, which means we a personal manager talks to each other and say, initially they'll have like a next 1 year plan on what they want to really do, and then cut it into quarters and see where exactly we are moving towards. So it's pretty much like an open culture for you to talk what you want to really do. So, yeah. But at the same time, the thing is like, and it's an individual transformation that sums up at one point of time. But if there are big initiatives at enterprise-wide level, there will be a top-down as well. So it's a mixture of both for us.
I'd like to give you like a real world example of that. It was pretty cool actually. So I was working at Spotify before I joined Sweetgreen, and one of the things was which relates to this is that I had the opportunity to work with very closely with a business partner, HR business partner. His name is Scott Dome, and he now leads talent for Netflix. And what he did was he decided that we needed a diversity function. You know, it was something which he thought was very interesting, which he held really close to his heart. And he basically went to the CEO and pitched a diversity function. And now it's probably one of the companies with the best diversity programs in the world, right? It all comes from passion. I think if somebody has a passion towards something, you're able to sort of articulate it in a way that brings people together and that allows you to sort of, you know, lead a group towards a common goal. So, definitely.
Yeah, I'll keep this really short because I know that we're tight on time, but I have a presentation this afternoon that you might enjoy given your question. One of the things that I think we make a mistake of in business is looking at transformation as being a one-off. In my worldview, transformation is absolutely continuous. And when we shift our view from looking at transformation as being a one-off event to a continuous event, we have room for bi-directional communication. And if you have great transformation efforts, you're going to find that you have both top-down and bottom-up occurring all the time, and they're feeding into one another. So I would encourage everybody to really start looking at transformation as being a continuous effort. And definitely not look at it as a top-down versus bottom-up, but rather those two sides of it working in conjunction with one another.
Mm-hmm. And it doesn't necessarily always have to be start at the top. Even individuals in organizations that the top hasn't bought into digital transformation yet, if you can look at the overall company objectives and the objectives of that C-suite, and implement on a very safe and, you know, the low-hanging fruit, the digital transformations that make happen what they wanted, all of a sudden it starts gaining its own momentum because it's a success story. So I hope that is. Oliver, do we have any questions on the line? Okay, any other questions here? Then what we're going to leave with is, why did we do this roundtable instead? This is the new way of communicating. You get cross-functional teams of experts mixed in with people that are involved, and you sit down at a table and you have a safe discussion where you can ask the hard questions and you figure out where the consensus is and how to move forward, keeping in mind what's the goal, what's the disruptor, what's the approach of the company overall, and also who are the people you have here and how quick can they meet and how quick do you need to meet, move. So any other final thoughts on that? Well, thank you very much for joining us on our little experiment here and doing a little just group conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.